Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
So happy to be talking today with Jared Yates Sexton, associate professor, author of the 2020 book American Rule: How a Nation Conquered the World but Failed Its People, and of course is the co-host along with Nick Houselman of the Muckrake podcast. So welcome, Jared, to Mind Shift podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm so glad that we finally got together. I've been following you for a long time on Twitter. I have to give a big shout out to my friend Janice at Divorce Religion. I think she might have tweeted something the other week about my show, and then you followed me, then I DM'd you.
Yeah, thank you, Janice. I appreciate it.
Yes, it's very good. We definitely have a lot in common because I'm really, really interested. I know, obviously, we'll get into the Trump stuff, but I'm interested in your backstory because I've been listening to your show for a long time, many, many months on the way to work. You talk about your backstory in evangelicalism. Did you come out of that movement yourself?
Yeah, so I grew up in this small little Indiana town, and I grew up, my religion was sort of, it was mostly Southern Baptist, but I also had like members of the family that were much more interested in the occult elements of other religions. So they sort of cobbled together all of the sort of worst parts of other religions and then combined it with, the Southern Baptist, or as I've come to understand it, which is a neo-Confederate religion.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, with all of those sort of elements came together, it was a really combustible, weird time. You know, I'd go into a church and it was all revelation all the time. You know, I mean, it was just, it was the church of revelation. And it was a mixture of revelation, charismatic preaching, apocalypticism, and American worship. And whenever you have all those elements together, it's also the story that's being told is a conspiracy theory. It's the New World Order. It's a supernatural Illuminati. Battle against Satan, Illuminati, all of it. Yep. And, you know, it was like when we would get home from church, we would either put on televangelists who were telling the same story, but it was sweetened up a little bit. You know what I mean? Or I don't know if you ever came across some Jack Van Impe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he wrote the book 88 Reasons Why Christ Will Return in 1988, and then he wrote 89 Reasons Why He'll Return in 1989, because he didn't return last year, so
he's
the one who wrote that book.
He was incredible, and just a real king, that guy. And yep. So, you know, we'd get home and we'd watch that, and then we would just, our text was both the book of Revelation, but also books about ghosts, aliens, conspiracy theories. And the weirdest thing about all of it, and just trying to make this relevant, is first and foremost, I didn't realize that was weird. I didn't know that, you know, because when you grow up,
it's normalized.
Yeah, you know, it's like when you grow up and you only live in a basement, you don't know there's a world outside the basement. Hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, I was like, man, that's a really weird thing that happened to me as a kid and into my like adolescence. And then all of a sudden, you know, we arrived at this moment in our political history, and all of a sudden it's like, oh no, that is like something that we are dealing with now. Yeah. And everyone's like, how could this happen? It's like, well, it was always going to happen.
Yeah.
And so it's a thing. And so I was pretty steeped in that. I thought about being a pastor for a while. I you know, would do my own little sermons and stuff as a kid, put together my research and stuff, but I eventually, you know, I started questioning at a very young age. You know, eventually I got a little bit older, a little bit more confident in myself, and then eventually sort of like removed myself from it.
You walked away from it all, but it wasn't the Trump stuff that led you out. Cause I know a lot of millennials for sure today, that's a big breaking point, isn't it? They're saying the Trump thing was the last straw. That was way before any of that, sounds like.
Yeah, for me, you know, it was like one of those things where I have this very strong memory. You know, we were talking about questioning and how important that is. And I had this moment when I was, God, I want to say I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I was asking a bunch of questions of like my grandmother about religion and faith and all that. And, you know, we weren't Catholic, but she called up a priest in town to like answer my questions. And, you know, he's like, oh, this is obviously demonic possession. And clearly, this like 7 or 8 year old is asking these questions. Obviously, this is unhealthy. But I sort of got to a point where I realized, and I think this is hard for some people to understand, right? I think when some people look at evangelicalism, they're like, well, one day you just tell everyone you don't believe in it. And then that's that. You know, because for some
just
people,
that easy.
Yeah, it's that easy. But where I came from and the background I come from, it was a thing where the fear of saying the word atheist out loud or agnostic out loud, first of all, you didn't know those words. But, you know, to say that you even had questions of faith was tantamount to the possibility of being excommunicated from your family and having a lot of problems within your school and your social circles and all that. It probably, from my teenage years, I held secret doubt, or I held my own place within my my movement away from it. But eventually what made me more strident about it was when I started recognizing in 2003, in the lead up to the Iraq War, I started to realize that the Christian nationalist part of the lead up to the Iraq War was this dangerous thing. And I realized that I needed to be open about what I believed so other people who were afraid could start to feel like they could be open and be honest. Mm-hmm. So I think it was the lead up to the Iraq War that made me like come out as being outside of the religion.
Didn't they write a letter? I've seen it somewhere. A bunch of evangelical leaders, I believe, wrote a letter to George W. Bush, essentially giving him theological and biblical warrant for that war, for the invasion of it. Have you seen that letter or heard of that letter?
Yeah, man, that I haven't thought about.
It's going way back.
In a long time. Yeah, I remember, it's weird talking about it now, like 17 years later. Mm-hmm. Like it feels like a totally different reality. But I just remember day to day fighting against the Iraq War and like going to poetry readings and signing things and getting these drives and signatures. And I remember very well when that letter came out, I just sort of like hung my head and I was like, oh, this is bad. It was really, really bad. You know, right now, actually, we talked about it before we started. I'm doing this research on a new book and like I just wrote about the Crusades. And all of a sudden you start to understand that like 2003 in the Iraq War was a crusade.
Yeah, they used that language.
Yeah, it was. And there's a reason. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Bush used that word.
There's a reason why you see on the back of pickup trucks now it says like infidel and it says crusader. And you know, you have all this stuff on all these shirts and all these pieces of merchandise. And you start to realize that like, no, this has been an undercurrent for a very, very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things I talked with Paul Kibble, who'd written a book on Christian hegemony, and it opened my eyes. I mean, I've obviously come out of that myself, Christian missions and winning the world for Christ and all that. But reading Paul Kibble stuff, it's like, my God, you know, in the West, we've had this Christian hegemony, obviously in the Catholic Church, and then even after the Reformation. But he said, no, you got to look at the colonizing efforts of these European superpowers have also taken Christianity all over the world. So it has been a hegemonic force for centuries and millennia. So it's a new thing. And the Crusades obviously fit into that context, don't they, somehow?
Yeah. So I didn't. And again, like I didn't understand what I've come now to call the cult of the shining city, which is what I've come to refer to as the evangelical white identity Christianity that's taken over our politics and has led us to the madness we're in now. I didn't understand that until the last few years when I started doing the research. But now that I'm doing like this farther back research back to ancient Rome in the Middle Ages, it's incredible that from the very beginning, this thing either, so Christianity has either dominated the world sphere and used secular forces like governments to project its power, or in that battle back and forth, the secular powers, the nations, have used Christianity to spread their power and their influence. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a dance back and forth that's happened from the very beginning, going back to ancient Rome. And there's an inherent quality to Christianity that makes this possible. First and foremost, it was like one of the first monotheistic religions, right? And that means I have the right God, you have the wrong God, period.
Yeah, which actually goes against the grain. Almost every culture has been a polytheistic one.
Oh, so I'm so glad we're having this conversation. So when I was looking at ancient Rome, it's like, if you actually look at what Rome did, Rome conquered all these different people and they would welcome their gods into their story. And all of a sudden, all the gods were hanging out, right? Yeah. So it's actually
took the Greek pantheon.
Yeah. Right.
It renamed actually, them. And
it was a pluralistic society. Like it had your gods, I have my gods, and they can interact. They get along.
Sure.
And actually, Christians, one of the reasons why they were persecuted is because the monotheistic part of it was seen as profane. It was like, how dare you come out and say that you have the one God? And weirdly enough, and just to get people in on this, when the Christians had to like practice in the catacombs, right? Whenever they were like, when it was
hiding under,
when that happened, it was because they were a monotheistic religion. They were seen as profane. And get this, the rumors about Christians at that time was, you know, in the dark, they're killing babies. They're abusing babies. They're harvesting their blood. And you know, not that that sounds at all relevant.
The first iteration of QAnon, right
the
there.
The first iteration of QAnon.
There
and by
it
the
is,
way,
right?
Yeah, it totally
there
was.
It is.
And then all of a sudden Christians gained power and they started saying it about the Jewish people. Right.
Yep,
and so it's
say,
just the
yeah.
same thing.
You just hear that again.
And but what you find is that it's that monotheism which creates in groups and out groups. Mm-hmm. We're right, you're wrong, and therefore, by the way, we can do whatever we want to you because we're backed by God. But you also have a perceived persecution. And what you actually find in the history of Christianity is, yes, Christians were persecuted, but it wasn't actually as bad as we've all been led to believe. They actually
horrible
sought
martyrdom.
Out,
yeah,
they sought out martyrdom. They
yeah.
And you actually have like Roman governors who are like, we don't want to kill you. Just stop. You know,
what's with these Christians?
Yeah. What's up with this? And so you actually see that even when they have total power, like they have control over like a country like the United States of America, they are still perceiving persecution, right? Christmas is under attack. And
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. How
can't even say
you?
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. We're back to saying Merry Christmas, right?
You and took our holidays, man. I heard a guy say that the other day.
In order to take office in America, you more or less have to be a Christian. Like there are obvious exceptions, but this is a Christian dominated society where the Christians still believe that they're being persecuted. So it's those features of Christianity that sort of lend themselves to oppression, violence, domination, oppression. I mean, it's all baked into the pie, unfortunately.
Reading through the description of your book, one of the threads that keeps coming out is this idea that's like there's this disconnect, isn't there, in Americans where they keep saying, this isn't who we are. This isn't who we are. The cruelty, the xenophobia, the separating children at the border and on the Trump's just hideous policies, even what he's doing now in the last dying days of his empire. And yet, it sounds like you're saying, actually, no, this is who we are. We need to face that. And Christianity, obviously, as you say, plays a massive role in who this nation actually is.
Well, yeah. And going back to that idea of like the tug of war between Christianity and nations, what you end up seeing actually is that nations start to cloak themselves in religious mythologies, right? Which is God is for the English. God is for the French. And then all of a sudden, the English and the
side.
Right. And then the French and the English fight over who God prefers. Right. Anything that you do, to prove that God is on your side is right because you're fighting a holy war.
Sure.
So as a result, literally every war becomes a holy war. Every action becomes a holy action. Saint Augustine of Hippo actually is one of the people who says, yes, there is right persecution and wrong persecution. Wrong persecution is what anybody does to people of the church. That's wrong. But the church can do whatever it wants.
Carte blanche, baby.
Because it's serving God.
Absolutely.
And what you find in America is from the very beginning, the myth of American exceptionalism is the idea that the God of the universe has chosen this country to be the arbiter of justice and his will. And when you believe that, literally everything you do, from the enslaving of, you know, generations of African Americans to the genocide of the native people to constant oppression of people of color and the poor and women, what you end up finding is America starts to have its own mythology. It's not history, right? Because our history, and that's why I wrote American Rule, our history is completely different from our mythology. And what you keep finding in our history is much more of a religiousized version of American history with its own martyrs and prophets, by the way. I mean, Abraham Lincoln is Christ. He died for our racist sins. And actually, weirdly enough, and you might appreciate this and you might even know this. So when Lincoln is killed at the end of the Civil War, he's shot and then he dies on Easter weekend. And they call it Black Easter, actually. So you have Easter of that year, you have like these black bunting funeral services, and they have pictures of Lincoln next to Christ. And, you know, because he died for our sins, and all of a sudden we're washed free of our sins of slavery. And then all of a sudden you start seeing all these pictures that start like very, very popular pictures, which are of angels lifting Lincoln to heaven. You see George Washington reaching out to Lincoln and bringing him to heaven. And then, by the way, you have a triangle. Yeah. You have the father, George Washington. You have the Messiah in Lincoln, and then the Holy Spirit is patriotism. And so you actually have this weird alternate reality in America where it is its own secular religion that's merged with Christianity. It's a very, very bizarre thing that we've done, but it's really the only explanation for why we've arrived at where we're at.
Have you heard of David Barton at all? Have you come across him in your research? David Barton, and he runs a website called Wall Builders. You'll have to look him up. He's a Christian nationalist. He is the quote-unquote historian of the Christian right. As soon as you look him up on YouTube, you'll find him. He's all over the place. But
he sounds great. He sounds like a great guy.
Yeah. I did a show with Dr. Warren Throckmorton about 6 months ago, and he spent years debunking his complete Christian nationalist mythology. But he leads tours of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. on exactly what you're describing, the iconography of the whole, you know, let me tell you the true story of Christian exceptionalism. Here it is all over the Capitol. You know, and he takes groups all over, these Christian evangelical groups. So yeah, I'm sure you'll love to dig into David Barton's work.
Well, I looked him up, and he's wearing a cowboy hat. So
he's out of Texas.
But I will say that when you have this situation, this mythology that is Christianity plus nationalism, one of the things going back to, you know, I was talking about apocalypticism and conspiracy theories. Well, Christianity as a mythology has this story, which is God is constantly being undermined by supernatural evil. And anything that happens bad in the world is the result of supernatural evil clashing against God. Yeah. And of course, mankind's lack of faith and holiness. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening in a country is a really convenient explanation. For instance, in America, I don't know how to tell people this, but we're not doing great right now. Like America... America sucks.
It's a mess. Yeah.
It's a total mess. And it's been in trouble for a while, you know, because of vast inequality and manipulation that has kept us from even understanding how power works. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening when you lack power and you lack understanding is conspiracy theories fill the vacuum. And it just so happens that, you know, Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the New World Order, Deep State, QAnon. They're all the same story. And the story is that puppet masters, Jewish people.
It's always the they, right?
Who are they?
I just want to know.
And they're obviously in league with Satan.
Oh,
right?
Clearly. It's
good and evil. So they then work with liberal traitors, right, who are inside the country, betraying the country. And then there are people of color who, because they're white supremacists, these people believe people of color are not smart enough to understand what's going on and they need to be protected by benevolent, you know, slaveholding protectors. Yep. And that story is the same story that all Christian societies has always told itself, which is we have to go out and conquer because these other people are trying to conquer us, right? So whatever we do to them is legitimate. And so we've reached this point, and you know this, it's like Jerry Falwell, the moment, you know, before the Twin Towers were even done smoldering, was like, God is smiting America right now. Mm-hmm. Or Pat Robertson, every time there's a natural disaster, God is showing America there's a problem. So all of a sudden, America is never questioned. it's always the people's wickedness or conspiracy theories that's holding back America and causing our problems. And it doesn't take a hop and a skip or a jump to get to Donald Trump and making America great again. And why the white identity Christian movement holds him up as a messiah. I mean, all this stuff is completely interconnected.
It is. It is. And somehow coronavirus plays into that too, doesn't it? I did a bunch of research back during the lockdown when I was working from home. And then after work, I'd had time to get online and do research. I didn't become a QAnon adherent though, but I found out a lot about it. But I did a study on what various Christian evangelical leaders were saying about the cause of coronavirus. Why are we experiencing this? And they couldn't get their story straight, but it was those narratives that you just laid out. It's God's judgment of the gays or abortion or corporate sins or whatever it was, you know, and it's
where they're trying to get the mark of the beast.
Yeah. That's the other one. When QAnon really exploded actually in the evangelical world, because here's these people, they were already susceptible. Well, it's basically it's like the Satanic Panic 2.0, isn't it? If you look at the Satanic Panic back in the 80s, it has a lot of the hallmarks of QAnon now. It's just dressed up and you've got Trump in there. So they were already susceptible to conspiracy theories. You know, it's a plandemic and the mark of the beast and vaccine chips and all this other stuff.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up the Satanic Panic, because I actually think this is one of the most misunderstood and unexamined moments in American history, that the fact that we don't look at it enough, I think, shows us part of why we're in the situation we are.
Absolutely.
For those who weren't alive during it, I cannot tell you how weird of a time it was.
I lived through it. I was in Christian high school during the 80s, so, man. I could tell you stories, man.
I was growing up a kid, and again, you know, I was growing up in this church that was talking about the New World Order and all this. On one hand, for those who lived through it, like, you would be told, like, there were Satanists in every community, people were being sacrificed. But then it wasn't just within church communities. It was also the country at large. Like, there would be like national news broadcast about exorcisms and ghosts.
Geraldo Rivera.
And cults. And you would turn the channel over and it would be talking about, preschool people,
day school,
transforming and flying and sacrificing children. And what you actually find, and it took me a while to wrap my head around it, but I think it's relevant for what we're going through now with like this QAnon conspiracy theory, Trumpism stuff. Well, what happens in the 1980s is Ronald Reagan, who is, of course, first and foremost, a corporatist, laissez-faire, pro-wealth politician, who, by the way, I wrote about this in American Rule. Everyone's like, oh, he's so religious. He wasn't religious. He was an occultist.
Yeah, his wife, Nancy was into, she had astrology, didn't she?
Astrology, and then Ronald Reagan is palling around California in the 1950s with Manly P. Hall, talking about secret races and secret destinies.
Come on.
And so he merges with the Falwell evangelical right. People misunderstand that too. They think it's abortion that is the animating influence. It's not. It's segregation. That's when the evangelical right took off.
That's what started it. Yeah.
Right, because as Martin
Brown
Luther
versus
King,
Board of Education,
right?
Yeah, all that.
As Martin Luther King comes out and is like, Jesus was a progressive, which is how the New Testament reads. I'm sorry, but
it's true.
You talk about like the meek inheriting the earth. You talk about
subversive message.
All this subversive message.
Anti-establishment. Yeah.
So what does Falwell do? And by the way, Falwell is from a long line of Confederate preachers who believe in white supremacy. And he changes the gospel to pro-wealth, pro-law and order, and he changes the direction of the evangelical right. And then later on, they figure out abortion is a much better talking point than Falwell saying there's a line of distinction between white and black people that God has drawn, is what he said.
He said it. Bob Jones said it. Yeah.
Right. And so then you get to a point in the 80s where Reagan and Falwell have this partnership, and all of a sudden you have problems with vast inequality, right? You're making sure that the wealthy and powerful become more wealthy and powerful. But meanwhile, the poor are becoming poorer. Crime is going up because people are more desperate. And also you get rid of all social safety nets. So all of a sudden crime goes up and people are suffering. So is it because of greed and inequality, Or is there a secret shadowy figure, right? An evil
pulling the strings.
Right. And so obviously it's not a problem with greed and inequality. We have a problem with Satan.
Oh yeah.
And so that's the 1980s are plagued with this bizarre supernatural witch hunt mentality. And what we have now is a refurbishment of that. It's a brand new type of that, and it follows the exact same trajectory, and it's the exact same thing, which is, and forgive me, but it's like prosperity gospel.
Yeah,
if you don't have money, if you don't have power, you don't have God's favor, because God's the one making decisions about who has money and who has power, and it just perpetuates, and it is it's really disturbing. But if we don't understand it, we're not gonna make it out of this thing.
Yeah, it's so true. When we return from the break, Jared and I are going to take a deep dive into this issue of how exactly is Trumpism the religion of conspiracy theories. In the first half, we've been laying the groundwork for this, talking about Christian nationalism, American exceptionalism, how that's all coming together. In the second half, we're going to start tying the piece together. I just wanted to take a minute to say a big thank you to the latest supporters of this show on Patreon. Thank you to Jessica Nelson Morris, as well as Janine Puckett, for being the two latest supporters of this show on Patreon. If you support this show at a $5 a month level, I will send you a nice little gift from North Wales, something you can only get here. And in fact, just because stores are reopening in the last couple of months, I've been able to start buying these gifts again. I've just received some messages from some friends. Ray messaged me on Instagram the other day saying thank you. He'd received his gift all the way to Austin, Texas. So thank you to the guys who support the show. I'll send you out a nice little gift. I also sent out a Mindshift Podcast t-shirt to Mark Wilkes the other day. He's out of Georgia. So once again, thank you to everyone who supports the show on Patreon. It means a great deal to me. Just nice to be able to send them a little thank you in exchange for their support. Let's talk, too, about what's coming up in the next few weeks and the next few episodes here on the show. We have dropped the first half of the episode that I did with Karen and Bonnie of the Deconversion Therapy Podcast. If you want to hear that episode, head over to their platform. The first half is on there. We're going to be coming out with the second half this week, so look for that. The next actual episode that's coming out this Friday is with Rebecca Drumsta. She comes out of a fundamentalist cult, Bible cult background similar to mine, so we have a lot in common. I've already spoken to Frank Schaefer. We did the recording for that episode, so look for the bonus episode coming up with Frank Schaefer as we discussed his two books, or at least two of the books he's written, Crazy for God and Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. Absolutely fantastic conversation. That's going to come out very soon, also as a bonus episode. Also in the queue, we have got so many episodes. I've already done these recordings, talking to Seven, who's a rapper out of Jacksonville, Florida. I talked to Paul James Caden of the Mind's Eye podcast. And speaking of Janine Puckett, I mentioned her a minute ago as being the latest supporter of the show. She and I actually talked a week or so ago, and we did a podcast episode talking about her backstory. It turns out she's very familiar with some of the names that I've been talking about in my bonus episodes of some of these failed Trump prophecies, these so-called prophets and apostles. She actually went to a church with one of the guys who's a very prominent one of them now. And so we have a lot to talk about. That episode's coming out. So I've got a ton of stuff in the pipeline. I'm just waiting for time to get it all out. So look for that coming up soon. Also, we have tonight, as this episode drops, the 13th of December, Frank Schaefer is going to be our guest on our monthly Mindshift Zoom call. He's coming in for the month of December, so that is super exciting. We're going to have Frank coming in, and then in January, we're going to have actually two. I've confirmed with Rebecca Drumsta as well as Jared Yates Sexton. So he's going to come in on the 16th of January as well, so I'm really excited to announce that as well. These are the benefits that you get for being a supporter of the show on Patreon. You get to be a part of these closed Zoom calls that we do once a month. So we're excited to have Jared come back in. All right, let's get back on into the chat with myself and Jared Yates Sexton. We're going to focus much more deeply now on this issue of Trumpism and how this whole religion, this whole thing has become a conspiracy theory, Christian nationalism, American exceptionalism. It all comes together. And of course, speaking of which, when we did this recording, it was Friday the 11th of December, and we mentioned this in the second half, the lawsuit that the state attorney general of Texas filed in his attempt to try and overturn the results of the election in various swing states where Trump had lost. What we found out after we'd done the recording, we talk about this a little bit, but at that time it was still in doubt. Well, we now know that it's been batted down by the Supreme Court. So it's interesting how quickly news develops. So let's finish up this conversation with Jared Yates Sexton as we look at the cult of Trumpism and how it's become the religion of conspiracy theories. I read an article by Dr. C. Peter Wagner. You may have heard of him, but he's influential in this Seven Mountains Dominion Mandate theology, and he's dead now. I think he died in 2016, but when Trump was a candidate, he wrote an article in Charisma Magazine saying, look, Trump is God's man, clearly, because he's already sitting atop at least three of the seven mountains. He's got the media mountain because he was a star of The Apprentice. He's clearly on top of the economy because he's a billionaire, and now he's going to be on top of the government mountain, so clearly he's blessed by God. So that feeds right into this whole line of thinking, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. And there's a couple of other things that really served as the foundation of Trump. One is Norman Vincent Peale,
who,
you know, Norman Vincent Peale, weirdly enough, has been taken from a pastor, which he was. He was one of the most powerful pastors in the country. Mm-hmm. He is taken from a pastor and turned into a self-help guru, as if those two things aren't interconnected in this country. You know, they're the exact same thing. I mean, Joel Osteen could not be reached for comment. You know? And so what actually happens is, and everyone's like, well, Trump's not actually religious. And it's like, no, that's not true. Like Vincent Peale actually officiated Trump's first wedding.
Yeah, I mean, that was his family church.
Yeah, him and Fred Trump went to these things because they were self-help sessions.
Power of positive thinking. Yeah,
right. The power of positive thinking. And it actually, weirdly enough, said that, you know, God chooses people to become their own gods is what it is, where you can actually change reality if you believe in things enough, which I'm sorry to tell you, it's one of the reasons why we're losing 3,000 plus people a day right now with coronavirus is because Trump didn't want to listen to experts. He wanted to positive think his way out of the pandemic.
Yeah.
Then the other part of it is that obviously Trump is the personification of the American meritocracy or the mythology of American meritocracy. Mm. He has all this money. He also serves as what the church would call a divine agent. Right. Mm-hmm. He isn't godly, but he will serve the interests of God, like a King David or
Cyrus
or an Emperor Constantine or a Charlemagne. Somebody who and by the way, all of these people murdered people left and right, pillaged people, raped and just
they got blood on their hands.
They got a ton of blood on their hands. Yep. But guess what? They helped Christianity gain power and purchase.
Absolutely.
And so now people are like, well, and I'm sure you're the same way. It's like, I read these articles. They're like, how are the Christians with Trump? And it's like, are you kidding me?
How are they not with him?
How are they not? I mean, he's Jimmy Swaggart mixed with King David. I mean, it's just the exact same thing.
Well, and that's my argument is that they viewed him as their Messiah, as you say, that Cyrus King David figure to help them achieve that dominion that they've been working toward. Because that's how I got into the political thing. It was through Christian Reconstructionism. Then obviously I'm finding out, well, that's kind of the philosophical, theological background for the Christian right, which is taking over the Republican Party, which obviously led us to Trump. So that's how I got there. You know, you got there in a different way, it sounds like, you know. So speaking of Trump, maybe we can kind of transition. We've been talking about him a little bit. Let's talk about current events. What the hell is going on right now? Because you were talking about this on your show. Is this a coup that we're seeing right now? A self coup, some have said. This lawsuit in Texas has just come out. You know, it's caused huge division. What is going on as you see it right now?
Well, by the way, this is one of the reasons I appreciate podcast, because this stuff is so in the weeds and weird. You know, it's like 280 characters doesn't always cut it.
Doesn't cut it, yeah.
So here's the thing with this situation right now. People are like, is it a grift? Is it a coup? It's a grift and a coup. Yeah, both things simultaneously. And what people need to understand about somebody like a Donald Trump is as a grifter and as an opportunist, Trump is a gambler. He's the kind of person who would sit down to play poker and play like six different hands. And he would play all of them badly. You know what I mean? Because he's completely incompetent. But he would play so many hands until he found something that worked. So what's actually happening now is, and it's really hard to psychoanalyze Trump because it's hard to tell where the lie stops and the delusion begins.
Yeah,
and
he believes his own stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah. And the closest thing, when I try and explain this to people, the closest thing I can find to an analog is a professional wrestler. And for anyone who knows this, just to give a quick little briefer, professional wrestlers, of course, are engaged in play fighting and play feud. Yeah. You know, they do it like two guys will have a fight, a fake fight in front of a group of people and take their money. Right. Yeah.
Sports entertainment, they call
sports entertainment. But here's the thing about it. Wrestlers are notorious because they lie so much, they get lost in their lies.
Right.
They get absorbed in their own mythologies. Mm-hmm. And if you actually listen, like one of the greatest wrestlers of all time is Hulk Hogan. If you actually listen to Hulk Hogan talk, he has no idea what is the truth and what's a lie anymore, right? It just gets...
I heard him say that, yeah. It was Hulk Hogan that had a 10-inch penis, not Terry Bollea.
Yes, you know, not Terry Bollea, which is, yeah. And which,
that's
by the way,
the person she wanted to have sex with was Hulk Hogan, not me.
Right. And which,
like,
by the way,
is a different persona, literally.
It's one of
character.
It's one of the most perfect explanations of postmodernism, period. And by the way, Alex Jones did this too. Yeah. When Alex Jones got sued, he was like, no, Alex Jones is a character. Yeah, right. And it's like, but your name's Alex Jones.
That's a role,
like,
I'm playing.
No, Alex Jones over here is a character. And so Trump, I don't think, understands one way or another the difference between his lie and his delusion. But in order for him to have an economic future, because for the next couple of years, speaking of Christianity, he's going to live as an anti-president, like an anti-pope. He's going to be a president in exile. And he'll probably go around the country. He'll be referred to as the sitting president. They'll play Hail to the Chief when he comes out. You know, he might
keep doing rallies. Yeah.
He'll keep doing rallies. Yeah. My guess, if I had to put money on it, is that like an OANN will build him an Oval Office set. And he'll just he'll just comment on whatever Biden does without consequences.
Yeah.
Well, in order for Trump to make as much money as possible and hold on to as much power as possible post-presidency, he has to put up the appearance that the election was stolen from him. Sure. Whether he believes it or not is different, right?
Right. He's committed to that narrative. Yeah.
Right. And so he's already raised, I think it's somewhere in the area of $200 million.
Yeah.
Right.
What a grift,
so
man.
The people around him need it too. The Republicans need Trump to continue endorsing and energizing their base. They know that Trump lost. Like they're unless you are a complete moron, you understand that he lost. Yeah. The Republicans understand he lost, but they can't come out and say he lost. Meanwhile, and by the way, this is a multi-level marketing scheme for anybody keeping track. Underneath Trump is an entire universe of grifters, podcasters, YouTube streamers, media personalities, and most of them know that Trump lost, but their money would go away if they admitted that Trump lost. Mm-hmm. So everybody involved, and by the way, not to mention all of the lawyers out there filing briefs left and right, they know Trump lost, but they also have their own brands. They're also raising their own money. They're also angling for their own TV shows. The problem is this, and this goes back to religion, and this is something that your listeners will understand and appreciate more than other people. You can say that things that are lies are goofy and weird and no one should pay attention to them, but if enough people believe them, that's reality.
Yeah.
And that's how cults and sects become religions. And, you know, it goes back to the thing about QAnon. You and I both know QAnon is absurd. Right.
Yeah.
And they're
Pizzagate,
like, oh,
and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're like, eventually they're going to round up politicians and traitors and hang them and put them in Guantanamo. And everyone can roll their eyes and say, this is absurd, until they round up people and hang them and put them in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
And so the whole point of this is that fascism and authoritarianism are battles for reality. And so what you do is you try and enforce your point of view or your reality on other people. They either accept it under duress and intimidation, or you disappear them. Mm-hmm. And they're not allowed to be in society anymore.
Yeah.
And so the whole point is, this is a grift, but that doesn't mean that it can't become a coup. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that it, like, since we've been talking, my phone is over here, right?
Yeah, it's blown up.
Well, no, it's not blown up. It's face down because I'm afraid that it will blow up, because I'm afraid that the Supreme Court amicus brief that they filed, and everybody says, well, this has no legal standing. Well, the law is made up.
Yeah.
And whatever happens around the law can change at a moment's notice. So people ask me, is it a grift or a coup? It is both simultaneously. And mm-hmm. and that actually should terrify people even more.
Yeah, it should. I've been working my way through Ruth Ben Gyat's book, Strong Men. It's just come out. So she's been on different podcasts and things. Mm-hmm. But I thought, oh, this sounds really interesting. So I've been listening to it on Audible. And she said one of the things about strong men and authoritarians is they love to manipulate election results to stay in power. Yep. And I'm like, oh, this is exactly, you obviously, you go down the line from Mussolini to Hitler to Pinochet to Orban to Erdogan. There's so many dictators in the 20th and 21st centuries, and Trump fits so many of those strongman dictator playbook sort of profiles, doesn't he? We're not out of this thing yet, I would say. I'm with you. I'm still worried about what could happen.
I'll tell you the honest to God truth. I think we're incredibly lucky that Trump is as incompetent as he is, and as glaringly incompetent as he is. I mean, we were talking about this on the Muckrake podcast the other day. It's a circus, man. It's like you got Rudy Giuliani, who's like, he'll go out and hold a press conference as like his hair dye runs down his cheek. The other day at a meeting, I assume you saw this too.
Oh yeah.
One of his witnesses was a ghost hunter, and while he was talking about this, he like literally farted in the middle of a meeting. Right.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Trump is just so buffoonish, and he can't even play the role of the president. And I actually think one of the saving graces, if people want a saving grace in all of this, is that he has pissed off the military so much that they hate him. Like it's an incredible thing for the military to turn against a right wing politician, but he's called them losers. He said that they've died for no reason.
Yeah.
Suckers. He's disrespected military leadership in one meeting after another. And they've sent out all these memos. They're like, you have sworn an oath to the Constitution, not to the president. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're not doing this.
Right. The frightening thing though, is that Trump, in his flailing, in his gambling, has exposed a lot of weaknesses in our system. And he's exposed a willingness to carry out coups and fascistic behaviors. What's frightening for me is if somebody serious and competent and disciplined uses that as a roadmap to power. And what's more is, and this is really terrible, and I'm sorry to bring the mood down, but we have a lot of looming crises. Our economy is about ready to explode, period. I mean, we're inching up on 300,000 dead from this pandemic. That's going to have ramifications for a while. We also have looming climate change. And if you want to see what happens with dictators and fascists, watch what happens when countries shrink and resources start to deplete.
Yeah.
And so I've started to look at Trump more as a precursor, more as a vanguard of something that could possibly come. So my antenna is way up because he is exposing a lot of rot and a lot of opportunities to other people.
Yeah. Well, I remember listening to, there was an NPR podcast a few months ago with Barton Gellman, and he wrote months ago articles about different scenarios, what could happen, which is happening right now. And he kept making the point that our system, no one's ever pushed it to this point.
No.
We don't know if our system can actually handle these challenges to the electoral votes and system, systems of counting votes. And he predicted it months ago. He said Trump's going to try and have electors appointed for him. And that's and so Gellman called all this stuff 3, 4, 5 months ago, and now we're seeing it all play out. And I'm not sure, that our system can withstand it, because it's like, it's not over. Biden isn't in office yet. It's very close.
And this is the thing, and I didn't understand this until I wrote American Rule, but the way that America was structured from the very beginning was it was designed to have safeguards like this. And by safeguards, I don't mean safeguards to keep tyranny out. I mean safeguards to protect the wealthy and powerful from everybody else and to override democracy. And so the Electoral College and the system of electors was put in place because the founders did not trust normal people to make the right decision. Mm-hmm. And so this would be like a stopgap measure. Like, oh, if they make the wrong decision, we could fix it, right? And
later,
people say all, yeah. And people say all the time, they say, oh, the founders would just be, if they knew about Donald Trump, they'd be rolling over in their graves. And it's like, no, if you went back to 1787 and said, the president of the United States is a white, wealthy man, it's, oh, everything's great. Yeah.
What's the problem?
Right. Because wealth to them was a denotation of confidence.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was their short-sightedness. They didn't expect parties to arise. They didn't expect wealth to rise to the point where it didn't have an allegiance to the country. They never expected to get to the point, which, by the way, is one of the reasons we're in this situation we are, is because they were so nearsighted, but also so hierarchical and really had terrible opinions of people. It's why we're sitting here waiting to hear about Texas.
Yeah. And that's why a guy like David Barton is so valuable, I think, to the Christian right, because he's spinning this Christian nationalist mythology narrative. He's the historian, as I say, of the Christian right. That's why he's all over the place on Kenneth Copeland's TV show. And he gives talks in Washington, D.C. to congressmen, senators, congresswomen. I mean, he leads studies that, you know, and that they lap this stuff up, because he's producing that sort of storyline. Well, now I know you got to get going. I have one last question for you. Yep. Now I heard your interview with Wajahat Ali on your show, which was fascinating. So off the back of that, I went back and found his New York Times article. Mm-hmm. Really interesting about reaching out to Trump supporters. I tried, but I failed. So, and I know everyone's asking this question, so tell me to, you know, piss off if you don't want to answer this, but is it possible? Is it doable to bridge those gaps? Can we reach out to those Trump supporters, or are they lost? Are they this cult member status where it's like trying to deprogram a Scientologist or a Mooney or someone who's just a complete cultist? Is it even possible?
Well, I'll start off by saying this. When we're talking about Trumpists, we're talking about the cult members.
Yeah.
We're talking about my family. We're talking about the people I grew up with. You know, it's like before I got on here, the only reason I have a Facebook is to keep up with members of my family and make sure they're okay. Mm. They have been completely radicalized, man. Like, they're sharing white supremacist memes. They're sharing QAnon stuff. I mean, pictures of, you know, Trump with Christ. So here's what I try and tell people. I think that we're having the wrong conversation. The conversation is, we really need to reach out to Trump supporters and listen to them. No, the problem is that we've been listening to them, because when Trump supporters talk to us, they're repeating propaganda that they have been fed. They're repeating propaganda and misinformation and alternate realities that don't exist. It's time to stop listening to them and giving them oxygen and treating this like it's a legitimate, because it's a bad faith alternate reality. It's been created by the right and Trump in order to control them, and the evangelical right to speak of. What I think that we need to do is, I think that we need to stop listening to them, and we need to start addressing the underlying reasons that they've been radicalized. Like, what makes it possible for them to be radicalized by these people? So what I would just say, my family believed in these conspiracy theories that I was talking about, that religion of the conspiracy theories, because they didn't have money and they didn't have power and they didn't have education. And when you don't have those things and you don't understand how power and economics work, you have to create stories. And when you create stories, they're just evil puppet masters who are against you, right? And by the way, that's why QAnon's so great, is it's like, yeah, you don't have power, but you could search through YouTube videos and find the right clue that brings down the satanic conspiracy. Yeah.
The cue drop.
So what we need to actually do is, because let's take Trump out of this situation completely and the evangelical right out of the situation completely. Rural middle America, Trump country, actually is hurting, like in a really bad way. Like, my town has just been destroyed. And I'm talking about lack of education, lack of infrastructure. You have a Walmart and then you have a bunch of people who either work at Walmart or shop at Walmart. And that's it, right? They're living shorter lives. Their jobs have gone away, all that stuff. That's legitimate.
Yeah,
I keep saying, we can win elections to decide who suffers more, or we can win elections to figure out how to fix things for everybody. I think that economic stimulus in so-called red America would go a long way. It would lower the temperature of radicalization and alienation. And like, so for instance, I was saying this yesterday, my family doesn't believe in climate change, but I'll tell you what would make them believe in climate change: a factory that produces solar panels. They had an economic reason to believe in climate change, they are damn well going to believe in climate change.
Yeah, I got a job, man.
Exactly. And that's the other thing. If you have a job, more often than not, you're not marching with the Proud Boys. Hmm. You're not marching with neo-Nazis. You're not in there with like the new KKK, because you're either at work or you don't want to put your job and livelihood at risk. The people who are becoming radicalized are more or less the people who don't have anything to lose anymore. Hmm. And I talk to a lot of neo-Nazis and a lot of white supremacists, and they tell me, we recruit disenfranchised, angry young men. Mm-hmm. Who don't have any association. They feel incredibly alone and they feel powerless. And we say, no, you're very powerful. Put on this armband and you will be powerful. Mm. And I think that we need to address the underlying things as opposed to reaching across an aisle. And I think that people will come along even though they might not even understand why they're coming along.
It's amazing to think about it. Yeah, I'm looking at the history. Is there any difference from that with, you know, Mussolini's black shirts, Hitler's brown shirts? Is there a parallel with that kind of stuff going on?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because if you actually look at the fascist movements of the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, what you find are economically challenged countries with a bunch of young men who don't have jobs. Yep. And all of a sudden you have fascist movements that say, no, you are powerful. We're going to get you a job. The alternative to this, and this is something else I read about American Rule, which I didn't understand. FDR's New Deal wasn't just about solving the economy. It was about giving young men something to do. Mm-hmm. It was about saying, oh, and by the way, fascist movements in America were very popular.
Oh, yeah.
We had an American Nazi Party. Of course, we had the America Right Committee with Lindbergh, who was talking about forming an alliance with Hitler. And that's another part. Hitler loved America. He did not want to go to war with America. He looked up to America. He gained a lot of information from America. They traded philosophers back in, call them philosophers, but you know.
Well, and Henry Ford and GM, they had the plants in Germany producing vehicles and all sorts, even during the war.
He said in an interview he wanted to support Henry Ford to become a Führer in America.
Yeah, he gave him an award and everything.
Right. Our eugenicists are the ones who went over to Germany and set up their eugenics program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they took their lead from us in the Confederacy and our genocide of the Native people. So what's important to understand about the New Deal and FDR is things like the Civilian Conservation Corps. It took young men who didn't have a job and gave them a job. And gave them something to do. And it reestablished the idea of what America was. And it actually probably de-radicalized a lot of young men and kept them from joining a fascist movement in America. And I don't know if FDR, I've never come across it before, like FDR saying this. I don't know if he knew that's what he was doing or if it just worked that way. Mm-hmm. But I think that we can gain a lot of insight based on that. And we can do it before we have our own depression. And we can go ahead and avoid a lot of the really ugliness that took place.
There's so much to learn from history. That's why I'm enjoying this book, Strongman, because, you know, I'm thinking, wow, we're seeing all this stuff repeat and replay. I was shocked at how many strongmen there are currently and have been for the last, you know, well, since Mussolini, I guess, was one of the first, if not the first. We have North Korea and everything else. And
we have a developing international consortium that looks a lot like pre-World War II. And I think a lot of people look at World War II and they're like, well, that was the end of wars, I guess, and we'll never have another world war. We're sort of, it's like a roller coaster. We're sort of like tracking up, and the tensions are rising. And there's a reason why you have a lot of anti-democratic leaders popping up around the world who are sharing information. I mean, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to understand that Trump and Putin have a lot in common and that they share information. There's a growing white identity terrorist movement around the world that shares information and coordinates. Mm-hmm. And we have a situation where, like, if a world war broke out tomorrow, and I'm talking about before January 20th,
Mm-hmm.
What side do you think we would be on? Would we be on the Allies right now, or would we be on the Axis right now? And that's something people need to chew on, is like things change in a hurry, particularly as conditions deteriorate.
That's right. Lots to think about. Well, listen, I know you got to go. You got another thing. We're almost done with your time. Thank you so much for chatting with me. How can people get a hold of you? One last question. What's the best place to find you? It sounds like Facebook's not the way to go.
Oh, my God. It's unfortunately Twitter. I hate to say that. I'm a J.Y. Sexton. Listen, it's a jar that we all scream in and our screams become commodified. But that's where people can find me.
That's the best place. And, of course, check out the Muckrake podcast. I love what you guys do. Thank you so much for your work and taking the time to chat with me.
Hey, thank you.